From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Brian Lehrer. This is just one segment of today's show. The rest of today's show is available for download and on-demand listening at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. Now to some analysis of the news conference that the president just gave. Joining me are Mike Isikoff, investigative correspondent for Newsweek, and Fawaz Jerges, Sarah Lawrence University professor, expert on the Middle East. Welcome back, both of you, to WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning, Brian.
Fawaz, I want to ask you some background questions about the U.S. relationship with the Palestinian Authority, since this was obviously a dramatic day after the Palestinian elections, and some of the toughest questions the president got at the news conference had to do with this. What aid does the United States give the Palestinian Authority currently? Do you know?
Yes. The United States offers about $300 million in annual aid to the Palestinian Authority. And that's a large, large number. This is the first time in history that the United States offers hundreds of millions of dollars to the Palestinian Authority. So the money is really pivotal to the ability of the Palestinian Authority to run and pay for some of its expenses.
And when the president was asked whether this USAID money, Agency for International Development money, was intended to influence the election on Fatah's side against Hamas by making the current government look like it was, you know, getting money and providing services, is that the bulk of the $300 million?
No, not at all, Brian. The United States spent about just $2 million on trying to help Fatah being the ruling party of the Palestinian Authority led by President Mahmoud Abbas. The United States was trying to help Fatah against Hamas. Obviously, the $2 million did not help Fatah at all. A major, major defeat. Truly, it is a political earthquake, Brian. It really transforms the political landscape in Palestinian territories. We are witnessing the rise of militant Hamas as the leading political voice, and the decline and the ultimate destruction, I would argue, Fatah. As you know, Brian, there is widespread perception among Palestinians that Fatah, that is the Palestinian Authority, is highly corrupt, untransparent, and unaccountable. And I think the Palestinians yesterday punished Fatah and the Palestinian Authority for all the failures and the blunders that it has committed in the last 20 or 30 years.
Let me play a clip of the president from the news conference, and Mike Isikoff from Newsweek, get you to react and tell me if you were surprised to hear the president speak this positively about an election that wound up with a Hamas majority.
Obviously, people were not happy with the status quo. People are demanding honest government. The people want services. They want to be able to raise their children in an environment in which they can get a decent education and they can find health care. And so the elections should open the eyes of the old guard there in the Palestinian territories. I like the competition of ideas.
So, Mike Isikoff, clearly he also denounced Hamas, but were you surprised to hear him use that language?
Well, he was putting the best face on it, casting the vote for Hamas as a vote against corruption by the Palestinian Authority. Unquestionably there's a strong element of that. But the real problem here is, you know, a point I made before, that Hamas is a designated terrorist organization by the United States government. I mean, the United States Justice Department prosecutes people for providing material support for Hamas, for having dealings with Hamas. It's illegal. So how to square what is existing U.S. policy on terrorism and the law with now a Palestinian government? I mean, if we continue to provide aid to a Palestinian authority governed by Hamas, are we providing material support to terrorism, which is precisely what we prosecute people for who send money to Hamas in the United States. I'm not quite sure how this is going to be squared, but I can, you know, rest assured there are a lot of lawyers scratching their heads about this right now.
Fawaz, do you have any guess as to how the president might square it, or do you think the $300 million that you referred to before is just going to be withdrawn now?
Well, I think Michael is absolutely correct. I mean, I think the Bush administration faces a major dilemma. On the one hand, it advocates and promotes democracy. On the other hand, the Palestinian people have spoken. They have said that Fatah and the Palestinian Authority did not deliver the goods. And by the way, Brian, Hamas ran on a domestic platform, not on a foreign policy platform. Its platform was anti-corruption and reforms of Palestinian institutions. And I think the president is absolutely correct. I think Palestinians were fed up, are fed up, with the corrupt Palestinian Authority. And the question on the table is the following now. How can Condoleezza Rice said today, she is looking forward to negotiating with the democratically elected President Mahmoud Abbas. Well, how can you talk to President Abbas and not to talk to the Prime Minister and the Cabinet that would be dominated by Hamas? The question on the table, I think there is a great deal of hard work to be done on all sides. I think Hamas, Brian, in the next few weeks and next few months will show its real face. Is Hamas committed to a genuine peace process? Can Hamas represent the Palestinians domestically and internationally? Will Hamas denounce suicide bombing and violence against civilians, not only against Israeli civilians in the occupied territories, but against Israeli civilians in Israel proper? I think Hamas has a great deal to show the Palestinians and the international community that it's a viable, pivotal political organization.
So,
and I would argue, Brian, too, I like Hamas to be above ground rather than underground. And this is why the United States and the international community must find ways and means to engage Hamas and see whether Hamas can transform itself and transform its platform.
So, Fawaz, just so we understand the structure of the Palestinian Authority government, presumably Hamas, with an elected majority in the parliament, will be able to form a government, have a Hamas prime minister. But Mahmoud Abbas stays on as president because he was elected?
Yes. The president is elected by the people directly. And he will be president regardless of who is the prime minister and the cabinet. And in fact, President Mahmoud Abbas just accepted the resignation of the cabinet of Ahmed Quraya, and he said that he accepts the decision of the Palestinian people. Obviously, he's going to nominate a Hamas personality, and the leader of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, said that Hamas already started talking to various Palestinians to form a government. So on the one hand, you're going to have a president who is very much liked by the United States and the international community, a prime minister and a cabinet that's dominated by Hamas, which classified as a terrorist organization, not just by the United States, but even by the European Union. It's a major dilemma, and this is why there's a great deal of hard work to be done on the part of Hamas and also on the part of the international community as well.
Michael Isikoff, I don't know if you're aware of this, but during the news conference, a story crossed the wire from Iraq that the U.S. government has released the five Iraqi women that hostage takers had demanded freed in order to release captured Christian Science Monitor reporter Jill Carroll. Did you know that yet?
I did not.
Yes. I mean, the story has been circulating for the last, actually, few hours.
Yes.
And I
was surprised because this came to my eyes on the wire near the beginning of the news conference, and I was surprised that nobody asked a question about it at the news conference. But the story that I saw was attributing this release to the U.S. military. And Mike, I wonder if you're familiar with whose decision that might be to give hostages, to give hostage takers, I should say, what they had asked for. And does that violate standard U.S. policy?
Good questions. I just don't know enough to say anything at this point.
Brian, may I add a footnote here?
Please, for us.
The decision by the U.S. authorities in Iraq was made a few days ago. And in fact, it was the Iraqi justice minister, that is, a week ago, said that the five women were going to be released. And in fact, the U.S. Army postponed its release of the five women in order not to create a link between the release of the Iraqi women and our Jill Carroll.
But wink, wink.
I mean, no doubts about it. I mean, make no mistake about it. There is the question of women, Brian, the detention of Iraqi women has been a highly volatile and explosive question in Iraq. Even though we are holding 14,000 Iraqis, there are just 8 women. Now 3 women remain in American custody. But the question of women, Brian, as you know, and as my, this is a culturally explosive, volatile question because there are rumors circulating, not just in Iraq, all over the Arab world, that American women have been raped and violated by American soldiers, even though the rumors are unfounded. But it has really created a great deal of anger and rage in Iraq and outside Iraq. And I hope not only the 5 women get to be released, and they have, obviously, but the 3 other women get transferred to Iraqi authority, Iraqi custody.
So this is not enough to meet the demands to release Jill Carroll.
I mean, the question, let's be blunt about it. I mean, I think the kidnappers were not just interested in the plight of the Iraqi women. They have been kidnapping Westerners. They have kidnapped, as you know, more than 260 Westerners have been kidnapped, and Muslims as well. So to say that somehow if we release all the 8 women, the question of hostage taking will end, or somehow they will release Jill Carroll, I think to misunderstand. You have criminals, you have thugs, you have terrorists, you have fighters, you have militants. This is a highly complex question. And kidnapping, Brian, is being used as a major instrument in the struggle that's unfolding in Iraq since 2003.
And Mike, on the Jack Abramoff questions in the news conference, was the president truthful, as far as you know, in saying, "I don't know Jack Abramoff"?
Well, he clearly has met him, and clearly acknowledges he's had pictures taken. I think where he skirted it a bit, I mean, you know, one has to take him at his word. He may not, you know, there's no direct evidence of personal dealings beyond these kind of meet and greet photographs. There's one meeting. One of the photographs is supposed to be at a meeting that was a little more substantive involving some Indian tribal clients of Abramoff who came in, but it appears to have been part of a group session, so you don't really know the interaction there. But the White House has also acknowledged that there were staff-level meetings between people, White House staff and Abramoff and some of his clients, and that's the one that probably investigators are more interested in at this point, because the White House has not disclosed anything about those meetings. They may be relatively innocuous or not, but you did notice that while obviously, you know, picture's worth 1,000 words, you know, the political impact of a picture of Abramoff with Bush is too delicious for Democrats to give up on, so they're going to continue to press that issue. But the more substantive issue are these staff-level meetings, and there the White House is being just as obtuse as it is about releasing the photographs.
Mike, 15 seconds. Were you surprised that reporters asked that release the photo question 3 times, 3 different reporters?
No, because certainly all the networks and, you know, do want to have those pictures out there. They would be great. They'd just be great photos to have. News value. Everybody would look at them.
All right.
But I think the staff level meetings are the more important substantive questions.
Fawaz Jurjess is the author of The Far Enemy: Why Jihad Went Global, and a professor of international studies at Sarah Lawrence. Mike Isikoff, investigative reporter for Newsweek. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
Coming up in just a minute, why men are now the distinct minority on college campuses. Stay with us. Thanks for listening to today's podcast of The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.